My name's Leanne, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Leanne.
Hi, Leanne.
I'd like to welcome everyone to the Simple Action Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a serenity prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen.
The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively. They're across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA simple actions. AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And the format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. And tonight we'll be discussing 8 and 9 Part B. Last week we discussed the beginning of 8 and 9, and tonight we're going to finish it up. And if you'll help me welcome our panel this evening, we have Mark and David.
Hello, everybody.
So step 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And tonight we are going to start on page 80. The chances are that we have domestic troubles. Perhaps we are mixed up with women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. We doubt if, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. But drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with an alcoholic, a wife gets worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative. How could she be anything else? The husband begins to feel lonely, sorry for himself. He commences to look around in nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. Perhaps he is having a secret and exciting affair with a girl who understands. In fairness, we must say that she may understand, but what are we going to do about a thing like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he is married to a loyal and courageous girl who has literally gone through hell for him. And we're going to start with David.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's David.
Hey, David.
Grateful to be here and grateful to be sober tonight. I have a sobriety date. It's October 24th, 1989. I was 28 years old when I got sober. I was a young man when I got sober. I was 22 when I first met you guys. I was an even younger man when I first met you guys. I was even younger than that when I qualified for Alcoholics Anonymous. I think I probably had earned a seat here, qualified for a seat here by the time I was about 15 years old. I have a sponsor. My sponsor is aware that he sponsors me. And and this is my home group. And I am grateful to be here. I'm grateful to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. AA absolutely saved my life. I describe myself as a reluctant member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't walk in here thinking I found my family, that this is a good place to be. I needed to stop drinking. I wanted to learn how to control my drinking, and I felt really kind of sorry for you poor bastards who had to come here and hang out and keep each other from getting drunk or whatever it was that I thought you were doing. But I didn't want any part of it, and I basically drank until I drank all the fun out of drinking. You know, I drank until I wasn't getting any pleasure, ease, and comfort out of alcohol. I was miserable sober, and I was miserable drunk, and I lived that way for years, just uncomfortably sober for as long as I could stand it, and uncomfortably drunk for as long as I could stand that. So I guess I'm kind of a binge drinker. Some of those binges were 6 months long, but anyway, I came to AA, and I was beaten enough to start doing these things to get a sponsor and start walking through the steps. When I got to the amends, I absolutely needed to have a sponsor because I was very interested in making amends to girls. I really wanted to show up in front of them and tell them how darn sorry I was, and I was coached in different directions. But this particular paragraph, I don't have a lot on it because I don't have a loss story. You know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I hadn't lost anything. I had blown a lot of opportunities. I'd missed out on a lot. I could have had a degree. I could have had college paid for. I could have, you know, I certainly was in a position to marry. I destroyed all that stuff. So when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous at 28, I was suicidal and I had debt. I had a job and I had debt. That was the only thing I had. I had no kids, no wife, no exes, nothing. I had pushed everyone away from me to the point where I was living in a house that was half paid for by a roommate who wasn't there most of the time. And I had cut myself off from everybody so that I could just stay home and drink. And if you were lucky, you'd get a phone call from me at about 10 o'clock at night and I could tell you what I thought of you. That was my life, just hanging out in the kitchen by the phone and the trash can in the refrigerator. So, but I have experienced both sides of this, and the thing that I'll say about it is in pushing those relationships away, I was kind of, I have experienced both sides of this. I certainly know what it's like to be disloyal to a woman that I'm in relationship with when I'm drinking. But what I also know is to be in relationship with me will make you tired and worn out and frustrated and looking for something else. So I've experienced driving women away. When I was drinking, when that happened to me, like anything else that happened to me that was negative, then there's a part of me that really kind of likes when you do me wrong, because it sort of justifies my position that I'm a victim, that I've been done wrong, and I get a certain amount of, I don't know, esteem from that, you know, on the bar stool next to you. Listen to what she did, blah, 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 blah. You know. So I've experienced this drinking. I've experienced it in sobriety with untreated alcoholism as well, being so restless, irritable, discontent, and uncommunicative with my spouse, she looked elsewhere. So I've experienced that sober as well. Of course, I perceive myself as the loyal and courageous gal. I'm the one who's gone through hell from everybody. So thank God for the steps. Thank God for sponsorship. The other thing I'll say about this is in sponsoring other men, one thing in my experience and in the men that I've worked with over the years, most of us come here with a fair amount of shame, guilt, and remorse, and most all of that is around the sex department. Most all of that is around our relationships and how we've treated the people who love us. And there's a lot of pain here, so I'm not trying to make light of that. Thanks.
Thanks for sharing that. Okay, I am Mark Henson. My sobriety date is November 24th, 2015. I have a sponsor sitting over there. And my home group is the Candlelight Group, meets Friday nights. Let's see, domestic troubles. I don't know, do we start with wife one, two, or current wife who's, you know, I'm going through a divorce with. My domestic troubles are, when I came in here, everything was their fault. I was a great guy. I provided everything. And if only they'd done what I wanted, you know, we would have had a better marriage. You know, the problem is, you know, I didn't always know what I wanted, but I wanted you to do what I wanted, what I wanted it done. So, wife number one, I honestly have a little to no memory of being married to that woman for over 5 years. Some of that is that I was on a ship and we were constantly at sea in the 80s. Some of that is when I was home, I was just drunk. So I drank into a blackout, and I always drank into a blackout. That's, you know, I used to think that meant passing out, but now I understand you. I'm still functioning, I'm doing stuff. It's just that the guy talking right now is not the guy that's functioning when I'm in that blackout. And people had to deal with that, wives had to deal with that. Sex relations, yeah, I had amends to make to the first wife in that respect too, because, you know, I thought, you know, I married her and we're gonna be whatever, but, you know, I left the girl I really wanted to marry in Florida. So I always had that communication going on with her. And, you know, I didn't, because I was drunk and didn't care when I was drunk, I was kind of blatant about doing it. So, you know, I had to make amends for stuff like that. Same thing with the second wife. You know, we got married for no good reason other than she was getting out and I needed somebody to watch my kids, because at this point in time, I divorced the first wife, was still on shore duty, had to get the, was about to go back to sea, and I needed somebody to watch the kids. You know, when we got married, I wouldn't have said that. I didn't know that was the truth then. But that's the truth now, and I know that now. You know, so how do you have a good marriage with somebody when you're home, you're drunk, and you've only gotten married because you were just, you wanted somebody to take care of the kids when you were going out to sea? You know, how do you have a good marriage with somebody like that? I'm surprised she stayed as long as she did. And she didn't leave of her own free will. I put her out because I was tired. You know, I was drinking, I was angry, and I was tired of her. And so I had amends to make to her. And when I went to, I don't know if I'm supposed to be saying all this, but when I went to go do that with her, because I just assumed, you know, that was the first person I wanted to make amends to, because I knew, of all the people in my life, I knew that I had done her wrong. And when I went to go make that amends to her, I thought it would be easy because she friended me on Facebook. Cool. When I was whining about my cable bill, she offered to help because she's some kind of executive with Cox Cable in Georgia now. And I'm thinking, okay, we got a relationship, you know, at least friendly. But when I went to broach that subject about talking about our marriage, she wanted nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with it. And I couldn't understand, because you're talking to me, offering me help on a cable bill, and I want to tell you, you know, how I regret being the person I was and trying to, you know, make amends in that respect. And she, let's say, wanted nothing to do with that conversation. Nothing at all. And it threw me for a loop when that happened, because I just assumed that it would be something that, you know, I was able to do and she would accept. But again, I was drunk. I was angry all the time. And yeah, that's the one thing I regret in this situation right now to the day, because I would love to get that done, but, you know, I foresee that that'll never happen, or at least, you know, at the moment that'll never happen. But, you know, what did I do? I threw her out the house, told her to be gone when I come back. No money, no nothing. And I thought, she did me wrong. She did me wrong. She was crazy. She wanted all this silly stuff. Good husband. That was a good alcoholic. She wanted a good husband. Anyway, that's enough on that. Let's move on.
Okay, on page 81. Whatever the situation, we usually have to do something about it. If we are sure a wife does not know, should we tell her? Not always, we think. If she knows in a general way that we have been wild, should we tell her in detail? Undoubtedly, we should admit our fault. She may insist on knowing all the particulars. She will want to know who the woman is and where she is. We feel we ought to say to her that we have no right to involve another person. We are sorry for what we have done, and God willing, it shall not be repeated. More than that, we cannot do. We have no right to go further. Though there may be justifiable exceptions, and though we wish to lay down no rule of any sort, we have often found this to be the best course to take.
Yeah, again, my experience doesn't fit neatly into this paragraph, but this idea that we have to be hard on ourselves and easy on the other person, I know I'm happy to, not happy, I have a tendency to want to save my own skin. I have a tendency to want to feel better at just about any cost, you know. And I will be motivated to disclose things to you which may harm you. I'm not considering you at all, you know. So, I mean, basically, the first 100 had a lot of domestic issues, right? Or a lot of extramarital. They were all coming up in a time where everybody was married and they all had girlfriends or whatever. I don't know. I didn't live that way. But I have to, I've always been coached to consider you first. You know, I can't disclose anything to you that's going to be harmful to you, even if it would feel really good for me to confess it. You know, we're going to talk about our parents in a few minutes. There's lots of things that I wanted to just blurt out to them that I've kept to myself. And I'm very, very glad that I was counseled to do that, because once you start getting, you start going down this road of making amends and showing up and being wrong in front of people, and you start experiencing some of these problems and some of the freedom that comes with it, you start wanting to do that all the time. So that's what I get out of this. I have to consider other people and whether or not it's a good idea to disclose information. Yeah, that's it for me.
Well, did I want to tell, you know, the things I had done to the wife one, two, or three? No, absolutely not. There's a lot of assumptions on what I did, and you know, I think there was no good to come of confirming any of those assumptions. Did I want to make amends for doing things I did? Yeah, I did that. But I just couldn't see, you know, handing out details of stuff I did. And maybe part of that is fear, you know. Maybe part of that is I think it's none of her business. I don't know. I can't be sure on that. But I did want to make amends for, you know, things I had done like that in the course of my marriages. But yeah, we'll leave it at fear as to, you know, why I didn't give full details. And really, I think, you know, sometimes that just causes more damage to admit to the things that people are suspicious of. And I did a lot of stuff to, you know, keep people suspicious. So, you know, I didn't make it easy on a wife. I did not in that respect. You know, most of the people that I'm friends with are female. So the fact that, you know, if you want to find me during my third marriage on a Friday, I was going to be at Applebee's surrounded by a bunch of women. You know, am I sleeping with somebody out there? Who knows? Is it an assumption to be made? Yeah, because this is where you're going to find me every Friday with all these women. Some of these women were friendly with my wife, you know, and yeah, I don't know what to say about that, but I wasn't going to confirm whether I was doing anything with any of those women who chose to also be friendly with my wife. Anyway, that's enough.
Okay, I'm still on page 82. If we have no such complication, there's plenty we should do at home. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs to do is to keep sober. Certainly he must keep sober, for there will be no home if he doesn't. But he is yet a long way from making good to the wife or parents, whom for years he has so shockingly treated. Passing all understanding is the patience mothers and wives have had with us alcoholics. Had this not been so, many of us would have had no homes today, would perhaps be dead. The alcoholic is like a tornado, roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken. Sweet relationships are dead. Affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. He's like the farmer who came up out of his cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarked, "Don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing?"
That's me, man. When I first got sober, I really wanted a medal. I wanted everyone really to appreciate the extraordinary effort that David was going through. You know what I mean? I mean, after all, I'm sober. You know how hard that is to be sober? You know, I should be excused from all other responsibilities. This is, getting sober is a full-time job for me, right? And if you'd asked me in my teens, in my 20s, and well into my sobriety, I would have told you that my parents owed me some amends. You know, I had a list of my father's sins, I had a list of my mother's sins, you know, and they had screwed it up big time. And they really, and if anybody was going to tell them about it, it was going to be me, you know. And because I'm a big fan of self-help books, I'm a big, you know, I got an armatorium of information I need to give to her. And sponsors tell you stuff like, "Yeah, why don't you just call her and tell her you love her?" You know, "Ah, he's just not hearing me," you know. But because of going through the steps and doing the inventory, and I began to consider my mother, you know. My mother, first of all, was married to my father, who was a heroic alcoholic, and so she was trying to raise three kids on her own. I was in the lead. I was told that I was to be the example for the other kids. You know, so I helped my little brother get drunk when he was 9. Taught my sister how to smoke dope, and you know, I was an example. My mother, at one point was so exasperated with me. I quit school. I wouldn't get out of bed in the morning, and she didn't know what to do with me. And she found a large quantity of felonious material in the basement of our house where I was living. It wasn't in my room. I had just sort of taken over this area of the basement. It looked like an opium den. It was decorated that way. It was really nice. But I basically caught these possession charges, which I got an attorney and beat these possession charges. And my mother, desperate to get some help from me, was counseled by her attorney to file a CHINS petition, Child in Need of Services. And so my attorney said, "Listen, she's going to file this thing. She's going to get up there and talk. What I want you to do is not say anything at all." And I said, "Sure." And I mean, I'm a minor at this point. And my mom got up on the stand and just broke down in this court of law. She's afraid to be there. She's out of her element. She is absolutely, this is not something on her list of things to do. And she just begins to weep on the stand about her love for her son and how dangerous his life is and how she's just doesn't know what to do with this boy, and she needs help, and she doesn't know what to do, and she's breaking down. And the way that I heard that, I swear to God, the way that I heard that was, "Oh, she should get the Academy Award for this one." I really believed that she was up there putting on a show for these people to make me look bad. That's how far I'm gone I am. And so then when the judge looked down and said, "Young man, do you have anything to say for yourself?" I said, "You bet I do." And my lawyer looked at me like, "Are you... just told you not to say anything." And I got up there and talked, and then the gavel came down, and obviously this is a child in need of services. So I got on probation. But that's just an example of what living with me was like for my mother. And that's the truth about what I put my mother through, you know. And that doesn't count the time I kicked in the doors of the bedrooms because they didn't want to talk to me. They wanted me to, it was too late in the evening to talk, David. Go sleep it off. And I kicked the doors in. This is what it's like living with me, if I came home at all, you know. So I'm a tornado. I'm definitely roaring through the lives of these people. And somehow in all of that equation, I come out the other side and they still owe me something. That's how twisted I am, right? So when the time came to make amends to my mother, and I sat down in front of her, she did not want to rehash the past. She did not want to go over the crimes. She said, David, I just always wanted you to be happy. That's all I want. Keep doing what you're doing. And then she said, but I would like one thing. I would like for you to return my phone calls. Self-centered alcoholic that I am, I drove away from that thinking, ha ha, I got away with that one. But you know, 25 years later, when my phone rings and it's my mother, I got a spiritual dilemma on my head. I'd never forget that. I've never forgotten that. And I take her phone call. And that's all she really wanted. That's all she ever really wanted was for me to call her. If I call her to this day, just ring her up and say, Ma, I was just thinking about you, what you up to? You'd think that I hung up the moon, you know? You'd think that I just moved heaven and earth. It's the most delightful thing to her. A simple phone call from an ungrateful knucklehead tornado like me. Thanks.
Parents. Let's see, I have a biological father. I have a stepfather, which, you know, when I say dad, that's what I'm talking about. And mom. Biological father, I hated my whole life. You know, and that was based on things that I'd heard, not actually seen. And stepfather, I idolized, you know. Him and his buddies, or who I modeled myself after as far as drinking goes, you know, because they drank a lot, they played hard, but they got went to work every morning, you know. But I was too young to understand that, you know, there were other things happening that were not seen by me. So I grew up, you know, idolizing that kind of drinking. And I knew that, you know, they weren't alcoholics because Uncle Joe was an alcoholic. He was the guy that, you know, was getting DUIs, was falling down drunk and all that stuff. So that was my idea of an alcoholic. They weren't. So that's what I was trying to be. And when mom and dad divorced and we moved, my brother and sister to a different city, you know, at that point in time, you know, I got to be, I was selfish, I was self-centered, I was an angry, evil bastard, even at that age. And with me being the man in the house, I got to be in charge. You know, so I did whatever I wanted. She had no say in it. Part of that was, you know, when she left my dad, she, you know, went to hanging out and leaving us alone anyway. So I had to be in charge. So at some point in time, when she slowed down, she wanted to come home and be mom. And, you know, this is probably a couple of years that, you know, this went on like this. And I had decided at that point in time that you can't be mom. And when she tried to exert herself into that, you know, I literally got her by her hands and put her to her knees. You know, I didn't have my car then, so I was 14 maybe. And I told her, you're not allowed. I got this, go to your room, be quiet. And I remember saying that. So, and at that point in time, I started, you know, developing a lot of hate for her. You know, how dare you, you know, bring us down here to this new city and then leave us on our own and then want to be in charge. And I wasn't having it. And I think my drinking picked up a little bit more after that. It was my first real passed out drunk. It was in the front yard of the house, and probably I was 15, 16 maybe. Had a 73 Thunderbird. I drunk like a fifth of, I think it was vodka. And somebody punched me in the stomach, and that you know what happened after that. And middle of the day, I'm laid across the hood of that car, my feet up on the windshield, passed out. And, you know, mom comes home and, you know, people drag me in the house, and I'm told, I don't really remember this, but I'm told that, you know, after they got through cleaning me up in the bathroom, that I was put on the couch, and I didn't move for 3 days. And I sit back and I wonder, what was she thinking? When she passed me every day on that couch, not doing anything. And then I was mad about that. But when it came time to think about these amends to these people, biological dad, mom, you know, I'm talking to my sponsor about it, and we get to the point where it's like, I'm cleaning up my side of the street. You know, it doesn't matter what they did. I have to take care of the things I did. Did I grab my mom when I was a child, basically, and put her to her knees? Yeah, I did. I need to go make amends for that. Did I hate a man for no reason other than somebody said something? Yeah, I need to go deal with that, because I made it known. You know, I'm never a person to hate you in silence. You know, you will know that I got an issue with you, you know, even as a child. So this man knew that I felt that way about him. And then the stepfather, eventually, you know, his drinking did get the best of him. And then he and I developed issues. And part of that was just, you know, well, I don't know. I can't explain him, but we developed issues. So I had to go down to Florida, and the biological dad is dead. Nothing I can really do there. But I go to a stepfather, and I start talking to him, and I'm making amends. And I'm realizing, you know, like I was saying with my sponsor, I'm mad at this guy for being him. You know, he was a certain way with me, and I accepted that, and I loved that guy. And, you know, when I was a kid, if he drove by, I'm yelling at him and chasing the car, daddy, daddy, daddy. And he never changed. But when I got older and had kids of my own, I expected him to be the dad I thought he should have been. And I had to, you know, talk with my sponsor, realize this guy never changed. I changed. My attitude changed. I developed the anger with him because I thought he should be doing something different, something that I wanted him to do. So I sit down and I go to make amends with him doing that. And yeah, I did my best there, but he's instead of that happy-go-lucky, hard-working drunk, you know, he's just a sad guy drinking himself to death. And he really couldn't understand a lot of what I was trying to get through to him. But all I could do is keep talking to him and telling him I love him and let him know that, you know, I forgive you. I hope you forgive me for the things I've done. And we'll see if he ever gets sober. He's 75, so I doubt that. But yeah, I felt good when I did that. But also through the process of talking to him, I learned things about my mother as well. And learning these things about my mother from him, and got confirmed through another person, was able to change my thought processes about my biological father. You know, I went from hating this guy to going, man, if you knew all this stuff, and you never said anything when I was going around telling everybody what a piece of whatever you were, you know, you just accepted my anger and never once tried to correct the record, you know. You're a better man than, you know, any of these people I'm talking to and me. So I had to go to his grave, you know, to have that conversation with him. And again, when I did that, there was weights lifted off me. Each time I've made an amends or a step and successfully completed that, you know, I literally feel like there's weights lifted off me, you know, and then I get some freedom from that. And then going to my mom, you know, I use the thought process that I've heard in the rooms, you know, some people are sicker than others. And I have to remember, you know, some people are sicker than others. Because at this point in time, she knows that I've gone to talk to my dad and gone to the grave. And she's sitting there like, when are you going to do amends for me? I'm like, I started to say, when do you deserve it? But I just said, some people are sicker than others. And I apologized to her. And asked if there was anything I could do to make right the things I had done. And all she wanted to do was hear me say, you know, what I said. And then she was good. She was good. But cleaning up my side of the street was the great blessing there. It was, you know, releasing some of that anger that I'd held on to for, you know, I'll be 51 in a few days. So, you know, 30, 40 years of anger. And some of it based on lies. You know, so getting that freedom and that weight lifted off me, man, that's an indescribable experience. And I hope I never have to get in a position where that happens to me, where I'm dragged down like that again. But I think as long as I stay here in AA and do these things on a daily basis, you know, I will maintain the freedom. I will remain what I would say is the first AA meeting I went to, I walked into the room and I saw a bunch of happy, shiny people. That's what I saw. And I can't see whether I'm happy and shiny, but I know I'm happy. I can't say if I'm shiny, but I want to, you know, stay that way, you know? And the only way to do that is to keep doing this, following these steps, living this life. And this life is through this book, and this book is, man, it's incredible. Enough.
Thank you. Page 83. Yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partially responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not to urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness will make a skeptic out of anyone.
Yeah, 10 or 20 years of drunkenness should make a skeptic out of anyone. But I got a new plan. I got a new deal. It's me. Come on, baby. There's a long period of reconstruction ahead. That sounds like a drag. That's not a quick fix. I don't like it. And then I'm supposed to take the lead, and I love the remorseful mumbling that we're sorry won't fit the bill at all. And I also thought that we ought to frankly sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past. I really, when I first read that, I thought, oh good, now I get to sit down and tell them what they've been doing wrong, you know? No, nobody else? I'm all alone? All right, fine. Thank God for sponsorship, you know, because, and I hear it in AA meetings, and when we start talking about the amends, the word apology creeps in there. I'm going to show up and apologize, and I got to go say I'm sorry, and all that stuff. My sponsor was very, very clear with me. He said, David, you're done being sorry. You've been sorry all your life. Now you get to be wrong. I don't mean to use profanity like that. I hate to be wrong. I can't stand being wrong. But this frank analysis of the past as we now see it was pointed out to me that the way we see our past now, David, is basically your inventory. You know, we've looked at the fourth column, and where have you been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Where were you to blame? Where were you at fault? This is how I now see the past in terms of what I brought to it. Yeah. And with my dad, I had a similar experience too. This is kind of an aside, but after he died, I found all my life, the mythology in our family was that my mother was a saint and my father was the sinner, you know? My mother ran my father down to me all my life, you know? And when she was really mad at me, she would tell me, you're just like your father. I did a few hours in therapy on that. But that was the mythology, and my old man never contradicted that. My old man never had an unkind thing to say about my mother. After he died, among his possessions were in dusty possessions. I don't think it was ever meant to be found. It was in one of his offices, up in the attic, was a private investigator's report from 1968 detailing my mother's love affair with a guy, and graphic descriptions of my mother meeting this guy at a shopping mall and them disappearing underneath the dashboard. And I'm reading this stuff about my mom, who had nothing good to say about my father, and my father never had an unkind word to say about her. So what I think about in that is, you know, we talk about fancy to real. A lot of these injustices, you may have really harmed me, you know, but you may not have. It may just be in my head. What I think is true about you may not be true at all, you know, but I'm willing to operate on that information. What I think, I'm so attached to my story, you know what I mean? Column B in the inventory, you did me wrong because of this and that and the other, and there's a story attached with it. And I'm the hero in the story, you know, and you're not. And I'm very attached to that story. And if you start threatening my story, well, David, maybe that's not even true. You got to go. You know, I can't hang out with people that want to talk about the truth like that. With my dad, my story was that he had done me wrong. He had abandoned the family. He had mistreated me when I was young. He had, you know, he wasn't kind, loving, nurturing. He certainly wasn't the father that I had in mind. I had a long list of stuff of his sins, you know. And through sponsorship, I was not able to face him directly. I prayed about it, and I just knew. I used to tell the story that when my father and I would get together, one of us would leave in tears, you know. The truth is, whenever my father and I would get together, I would leave in tears. It was very difficult to get along with him. And because prior to getting to this step, I was always trying to extract something from him. I was always trying to get his admission of fault. I really wanted him to claim his side of the street, you know? And he just wasn't cut from that cloth. He just, you know, do the best you can, you move on, son. That's the way that is. And I wanted something else from that. And you guys told me, well, why don't you, did you lie to your father, David? Oh, yeah, yeah. So you were dishonest with your father? Write that down. Did you steal from him? Oh, yeah, of course I stole from him. Yeah, he had plenty of money. He was a veterinarian. He had a whole cabinet of medicine that I could pilfer. That was awesome. You know, he had to, this guy, did I ever consider this guy? This guy was a proud guy. He was proud of himself and his achievements, that he had become a doctor or a veterinary medicine. He was very proud of that. And he had to fire his idiot son because his idiot son couldn't stay out of the medicine cabinet. You know, I didn't even deserve the job. And I'm taking stuff from him. So I got permission to just write a letter telling him, look, I lied to you. I cheated. I took money from you under false pretenses. I made a list of the things that I had done to him, and I did not ask for his forgiveness. I didn't ask for his agreement. I was paralyzed with fear that it would happen like everything else in my family, like we wouldn't acknowledge it, you know? It just wouldn't be acknowledged. So I asked him, I said, in the letter, I said, I just want to know that you read this letter. You know, would you give me that? So he wrote me back a letter saying, David, you always give me the hardest tasks. And that's the truth, you know. But what he said in the letter was, I don't know how much longer I'm going to live. How about you and I go for the good from here on out? That was it. He didn't admit he was at fault. He didn't admit he was wrong. But he said, let's just go for the good from here on out. And this is the long period of reconstruction. Because I would show up in front of him. I would visit him. I tried to help him with his computers, things like that. I just started looking for ways to be of service because that's what you guys taught me to do. And he never got sober either. And he'd get about halfway through a half gallon early times, get feeling good. And then he'd engage in the Francis family sport, which is recrimination. And he'd start giving me a hard time about, remember that shit you did, that stupid thing, you know, and I'd just say, oh, Pop, I thought we agreed we were going to put all that behind us. That's all I'd say. And he'd say, right you are, lad. Right you are. And the thing about that is, we're dealing with spiritual principles here. And I showed up in front of him and I admitted that I was wrong. And I didn't demand an apology from him. I didn't demand anything from him. I was wrong. I made my admission. I did not treat him that way ever again after that. And a half a gallon of whiskey can't even overcome that. He's half in the bag drunk. Right you are. He and I were friends when he died. I miss him every day of my life. Because of you and because of this, not because of my new plan or my idea, something I came up with. I just showed up in front of him and was wrong about some stuff. And then I shut up, which is completely unnatural for me. So, yeah, these are the things I think of. I love the line that our behavior is going to convince them more than our words. You know, I've said a lot of words that didn't amount to anything to a lot of people, particularly the ones who love me. And it makes sense that after 10 or 20 years of drunkenness, they're not particularly interested in what I have to say. But what's normal in my family today is I'm expected because I show up. It wouldn't occur to them that I wouldn't show up. Because of you and because of this, I'm there. I'm available to my family. I'm expected. I'm not a wild card anymore. I'm not a question mark anymore. And not because of my will to be a good guy or to do the right thing. I just do this and try. It also mentions pretty significantly in here that I'm going to need to ask the Creator for the power to do these things. That I don't have it on my own. Thanks.
We're talking about period of reconstruction. Chances are our own actions are partly responsible. And, you know, that reconstruction thing takes me to thinking about being in charge. And that takes me back to, I think it's 62, where we had to quit playing God and we had to stop trying to manage everything. when I remember that and I practice that, meaning I don't have to be in charge anymore. You know, life got easier. As long as I'm just a willing participant trying to be helpful, life is easier. When I go back or when I slip back into the idea that I'm right, you're wrong, we're gonna do it my way, shut up. You know, life gets difficult. And I have to take the time to, you know, correct myself on that. You know, but everybody dealing with me that way my whole life, you know, they're not used to the new way I am. So they're baffled by it. And it's to be understood, you know, people who've known me my whole life are all of a sudden like, he wants to give me an option? He wants to give me a choice in this matter? What's the deal here? But I just have to keep doing what I'm doing. Not worrying about fixing you, correcting you, telling you how to do whatever. And by me allowing you to do you, I can maintain my freedom of choice. You know, my peace of mind. And I think that's one of the most valuable things I've gotten out of here is peace of mind. You know, because if you're always worrying about fixing somebody else and correcting somebody else's situation, you never got peace of mind. And with this peace of mind that I have, you know, I have developed patience. And that serenity prayer is amazing as far as, you know, recentering me when I do get upset. You know, and there was a time in my sobriety here that I was at a Home Depot and there was a lady in front of me and she was acting really silly. And I'm standing in line behind her and I'm thinking, well, how can I help her? And I offer to help her and she just, you know, gets even nastier with the cashier and ignores me. And so I start getting upset because I'm thinking you're holding me up. But then I realize, you know, just say the serenity prayer. And then I didn't have to be in charge anymore at that point in time. I said the serenity prayer, and I was able to sit there and patiently wait behind this woman. And the thing that makes it worse on my part is I'm retired. I didn't have anywhere to be. I was just buying something and going back home. So why am I upset that this lady has taken so long? But in the past, you know, that would have required action on my part. Not just requires me to be patient, offer help, say the serenity prayer so I can maintain my peace. And as long as I maintain my peace, the rest of the stuff just, you know, works itself out. I don't have to make anything happen anymore. Thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, I'm going to read these last two paragraphs. We've got just a couple of minutes left. Page 83. There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would write them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. And there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. in the last paragraph. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going into a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.
Yeah. So we stand on our feet. We stand on our feet, look them in the eye, and are wrong. I can be wrong. I share that. I make a big deal out of that because that little template of showing up and saying, hey, man, I treated you unfairly. I failed to consider you. I lied to you. I stole from you. You gave me a job, and I didn't treat it with proper respect. Whatever it is, simple statement, I was wrong, and I'm here to make that right if I can, and shut up. Very little falls outside of that. They'll always materialize if we work for them, if we do the work, right? We love the promises because we get stuff. You know, it feels good. We read them at every meeting. I love a new freedom and a new happiness. But I think "we think not" is the least quotable line in the whole thing. That's my opinion. Throw it out. They will always materialize if we do the work. And the other thing I'll say this and I'll just shut up. I am absolutely certain. I came here as a militant atheist, and I sit here today absolutely certain that God has done for me what I cannot do for myself. That it is nothing but the grace of God that brought me to you. You know, I used to say that my best thinking got me a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. I do not say that anymore. My best thinking gets me driving around the city of Norfolk looking for buildings to jump off of. That's the best I can do. The grace of God brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous and a planned program of action that if I follow it, I get the results that you guys have detailed in these beautiful promises. So I absolutely believe that. But I also believe that I have to work for them. Thanks.
I'm going to say ditto on the atheist part, but no longer. I have found a higher power here. That higher power has given me peace. What I have also found is I love these 9-step promises. And I realized at some point in time, you know, some meetings read it as like a numbered bullet style, and some meetings read it as a paragraph. And when they were doing the numbered bullet style, I stopped listening. I wasn't listening to it. I like it as a paragraph. I hate it as a bullet. But, you know, I realized that I wasn't paying attention at all because I was looking for the way it was being presented, vice what was actually being said. But what I found is that by doing these steps, I have found a new freedom. I have found happiness. And happiness is something I hadn't had in years, decades. I didn't realize that. It wasn't until I was in a room where somebody was laughing and overjoyed and whatever, and I was angry. I was angry at him because he was in my meeting laughing. And I'm like, when did it become my meeting? Why am I mad at him for laughing? And I realized I'm mad at this guy because he's happy. And I haven't been happy in a long time. I've been miserable forever. Hadn't been happy in a long time. But through these steps, I have found happiness. I have found freedom. Each step was a weight lifted off me. You know, from the very beginning when it talks about being rigorously honest, man, I did not write lie. I just like to omit. So, you know, but now I don't have to omit anything. I'm not doing anything that requires me to lie or omit. I'm just doing the right things. And that's a freedom. You know, finding that higher power is a freedom. Understanding that as spiritual malady and beginning to solve that problem through spiritual steps was a freedom. Each one of these freedoms gave me it took that weight off me, the weight that I carried around that I didn't really know was there. but I felt it when it left. You know, doing the inventory, you know, making amends, all these steps were, you know, there was a little bit more freedom with each one of these steps. And as long as I keep doing this, which is what, you know, 10, 11, 12 tell me to keep doing, then I can keep this freedom, I can keep this happiness, and life will be good. Will not be perfect, but it will be good. So if you're new, you have done the steps, I invite you, do the steps. Get the freedom that's promised in the nine-step promises, and maintain your peace and serenity and happiness. And that's all you got to do is follow these steps. Thanks for letting me share that.
Thanks, Mark.
All right, we're going to pass the seven tradition baskets. The seven traditions states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group rent and other expenses, seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Although the amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world, we may want to remember that a dollar does not support as many services as it used to. And are there any AA-related announcements?
Hey everyone, I'm Travis Alcoholic.
Travis!
On Saturday, September 30th, my home group, Uptown Young and Sober, is doing a workshop with Downtown Young and Sober. It's going to be called a Seeds of Growth workshop. That's starting at 2 p.m. at Beach Garden Park, which is out by Virginia Beach Oceanfront. There's going to be grilling, bring a dish if you wish, some good fellowship, and then an ultimate frisbee tournament. If you have any questions or want to talk or concerns, talk to me about it after the meeting. Thanks.
Any other announcements? Grant.
Grant, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Grant.
Virginia Area Council sponsors the CPC and PI committees to do an event on September 30th. The event is actually to invite out professionals to find out what Alcoholics Anonymous is and isn't, and what we do for the suffering alcoholic. If you want to know more about the event and help spread the word, come see me after the meeting. If you're interested in getting involved in service, CPC and PI can always use your help. CPC meets the first Thursday of the month, and PI meets third Tuesday of the month. If you want to know more about that, see me after the meeting.
Thanks.
I'm Stephanie, I'm an alcoholic. The Wakefield Campfire Conference is coming up September 22nd, 23rd, 24th in Wakefield. It's $70. It's all your meals for the entire weekend. There's women and men's dorms separate. There you can tent, sleep in tents, you can bring an RV, see me after the meeting, or there's flyers up there, or go to WakefieldCampfireConference.com.
Thank you. Any other announcements? Okay, I just have a couple up here. This group is having a separatist speaker Monday, October 16th. Potluck starts at 6. Bring a dish if you can. 7 p.m. The speaker is coming from Madison, Virginia. His name is Billy H. That'll be right here in this room, October 16th. There's a flyer up here for the Shenandoah Valley Roundup, September 22nd and 24th in Harrisonburg, if you're interested. And also, Bayview United Church of Christ is having a potluck dinner at 5 o'clock and then a panel of speakers, and that is going to be September 17th. That's coming up real soon, so there's a flyer up here. All right. Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, if you'll raise your hand. Just see one of us if you'd like to join this group. We'd love to have you. Is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? We'd like to welcome you. If you'd just like to raise your hand and give us your first name so we can welcome you. All right. Literature is available on the table. Books have a small price. They're written on the inside. If it's paper, you can fold it. It's free for the taking. And you can see me or one of the home group members after the meeting if you want to buy a book. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, I will be available up here at the table at the close of the meeting, so please feel free to come up and ask any questions you might have. Smokers, please use the buck can outside and stay well away from the church doors. And all of our meetings are recorded on our website, simpleactions.net, if you go to audio, and you can go back and listen to all the speakers that we've had the past couple of years. And closing, I'd also at this time like to thank Mark and David. Please feel free to come up and thank them or talk to them about what they shared. Thanks to all who participated. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be at Plaza del Sol, 22nd and Colonial. It's a little Mexican place up the street we go to after the meeting. Do I have a volunteer to read the last two paragraphs on page 164?
Hey everyone, I'm Travis Alcoholic.
Travis!
Our book is meant to be suggested only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Amen.
Thank you. We'll close with the Lord's Prayer for those that care to join. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not to temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.